First, let's go ahead and pray for it. Always bothers me when the flag's on the wrong side. I think it's on the wrong side. It's supposed to be on its own right. So assuming that it's facing this way, that you wouldn't do it differently in a court, it should be over here. I was flag safety in sixth grade. I remember these things. Huh? I was tempted, but it's behind a bunch of stuff there. So, and I didn't know if there's a different role in a courtroom. Like, you know, somehow the people, the center of attention at the courtroom. I would think this is the center, and the right is over here. So, state the flag is supposed to be on stage right. Yeah. It's that time. It's kind of what the Bible says about the end times. You won't know right from wrong or right from left. All right. Looking for light. Nope, I don't have light. See how much I can read without my glasses. I've got them. Huh? Yeah, there are lights up there. Maybe I'll be able to see. All right, what we're going to do today is, if you read with me, or I could get somebody to read, if anybody feel like reading, Luke chapter 19, verses 11 through 27. It's popularly known as the parable of the pounds because of the English translation. All right, Arlene's in the back. You want to read? You can read the whole thing if you like. Luke chapter 19, and we're going to start in verse 11. And we'll read on down to verse 27.
Okay. As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable, because he was near to Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, a nobleman went up into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom, and then returned. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas, and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called on. He called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. First came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank? And at my coming, I might have collected it with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him, and give it to the one who has the 10 minas. And they said to him, Lord, he has already 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me.
Thank you. What version, translation are you reading?
English Standard
Version. English Standard Version. Okay, thank you. Because of that, I've got a King James up here today, and we'll be talking about what some of the words mean. And the English Standard Version already has some of them translated differently, which is helpful. This parable is called the Parable of the Pounds because in the King James it uses the word pound instead of mina, and it's referring to money. And so that's why we have that kind of title for this parable. If you're like me, you probably don't want to be like me, but if you're like me, over the years you've heard this parable, and it's a story to tell us to make the most of the talents that we have. And actually in Matthew 25 there's a similar parable, which I feel is a different one. Some people say it's two versions of the same one. But there's one where it actually uses the term talents, and it's talking about a weight, you know, something that has value, like a weight of silver. So it's money. But, you know, we have our term talent from that you have certain talents. So we tend to think about this in terms of using our talents to, you know, for good, or God will take them away. And we tend to also think that this is teaching us to work hard, and if we work hard for God, God will give us a reward. And maybe a bigger reward the harder we work. Now, I'm not going to take issue with that, those principles. They are biblical principles. We could turn, I'll just read here, Matthew 16, verses 24 to 27. We're not going to turn very many places. It's going to stick in Luke here, but to start off, I'm going to turn to Matthew 16 and verse 24. Excuse me. Jesus said this to his disciples, "If any man will come to me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And whosoever will save his life will lose it. And if you lose your life, you'll save it." It's like, you know, it's going to work the other way. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? In verse 27, it says, "For the Son of Man shall come in his glory, in the glory of the Father, with his angels, and then he will reward every man according to his works." According to his works. So that's a biblical principle. If you're taking notes, you can write down Romans chapter 2 and verse 16, which says the same thing. So the Bible does teach that we're going to be rewarded according to our works. But does this parable teach us that? And is that what the purpose of the parable is? Recently had a conversation with a friend who was telling me that she was on a bus trip somewhere and you know, struck up a conversation with the lady that was next to her, and that lady said, you know, just came back or just recently had a Bible study at our study group or church or wherever she went, and it was on the parable of the talents and pounds, so those parables. And the lady said, she said, "Well, I don't think I really have a handle on it. Like, I think I understand it better because we had this study, but I still don't understand it." And my friend was saying to me that she kind of felt the same way. Like, well, you know, what is it saying? And that got me to studying into it. And that's why we're having the sermon today, because I spent some time studying this parable and the one in Matthew. We're going to spend our time here in Luke. Matthew's parable, like I said, is a little bit different. I'll refer to certain things in that one as we go. But as I studied this parable in Luke, the parable, what we call the parable of the pounds, I found that it didn't say what I thought it said, or its purpose was not necessarily what I thought the purpose was. So I want to share that with you. I want to share the things that I learned and share some of the context and background. We'll look at it today. We'll learn about its context, the context of the parable, its structure, and from that, it'll help us learn a little bit more about its meaning. And I think that you'll find, as I did, that this parable has much more in it. It has much more to say than just, hey, if you work hard, God will reward you. It's got a lot more in there. And actually, maybe we have, at times, stressed the wrong things. Or put stress on the things which are not as important in the parable. I know I did. So this was helpful for me to go through. I want to share with you some of the things I've learned. So what we're going to do first, actually the bulk of the sermon, is just going to be going through the parable verse by verse. And some verses there's a lot to say, a lot to learn, other verses there's not. But let's go through it one verse at a time and see what it has to say. Beginning in verse 11, I've got to turn back one page. And it says, "As they heard these things," that's what I'm reading in the King James, "as they heard these things," well, I'm going to stop right there. What had they just heard? What is the context of this particular story? Luke places at a certain point in his book, and we have to remember, I've got this in my notes later, but I'll just say it now. We have to remember that Luke is not an eyewitness, right? Luke is somebody who's writing the story later because he wasn't there. And he's asking people who were there for their, you know, what they know. And maybe there are already written things by the time Luke writes his gospel. So he's taking other information and he's putting it into a certain format. And I've gone through some of that before, showing you how he used certain characteristics of Hebrew poetry in the way he wrote. And he also has what's called the travel narrative, which goes from about, I think it's chapter 9, up here to chapter 19. And this is things that Luke writes as if they happened on his way from Galilee down to Jerusalem for the final Passover that he kept when he was killed. Now, did these things happen exactly in the order that he's telling them? That's something you can decide for yourself. I think not. I think Luke was writing with a purpose. He puts one story after another story, and I've mentioned this before, because they go together in what they're teaching. Jesus was telling his parables over and over again. He'd go to this city and tell them. He'd go to that city and tell them. So chronologically, maybe it doesn't make any difference when he told them, because he told these stories every, you know, they didn't have, he didn't record them on a tape and then just send the tape around. He had to go on foot from town to town to town, and he would tell the stories again and again and give his sermons again and again, or whatever you want to call them, his teachings. So they were done many times. And when the gospel writers get around to writing the gospels, they're taking versions of the story that they either heard themselves or they heard somebody else told them about. And I would imagine that Jesus didn't tell the same parable in the same way in every town. Because, you know, you got a local color in a certain town. You can make a point, drop a name here or there, and it means something to them. Where if you say that in another town, they'll go scratching their heads. Like, what's he talking about? I don't know what he's talking about. So you can change your your sermon just as I would. If I give the same sermon here, if I go to Cincinnati and give it, and maybe my sermon here has to do with somebody you know, I go to Cincinnati and I don't use it the same. I use somebody else. I change it so that it's relevant to them. I'm sure, you know, without being there on the ground to know for sure, but I'm sure that Jesus did the same thing. You want to relate to your audience. So Luke is writing his version. He's putting in a certain order to make a certain point. And he says, as they were hearing these things, well, what did Luke talk about in the gospel here right before he puts this parable? It's when Jesus had passed Zacchaeus, all right? He's near Jericho, right? And he's passing Zacchaeus' house, and he says, today salvation has come to your house. Something, I think that's what it says there in the King James. Today salvation has come to your house. What we have to realize then, the context of telling this next parable, is that Jesus is on this he's on this journey, if you want to put it that way, on to his last Passover. But to the people, they weren't thinking this was going to be his last Passover. What did they think it was going to be? They thought he was ready to assume the Messiahship. He's going to do what he came to earth to do, to lead the people against Rome and have the kingdom of God on earth and all that. And they were expecting that, especially when he says something like, Zacchaeus, salvation has come to your house today. You know, that's like, Jesus is in a position to grant that because he's going to be the king. And then after this parable, right afterwards, what does he do? He enters into Jerusalem. He walks from Jericho up to Jerusalem. Remember, that's about 6 miles. It's over a half mile in elevation difference. It's uphill all the way. And it takes about 6 hours to get there. And when he gets to Jerusalem, remember, they get the donkey, the colt that he has to ride into town. They treat him like a king. Because the people, not everybody, but you know, the majority of the people that knew about him thought, this is the time. He's the king. You know, hail to the king. So that's their expectation. And that's the context. And then, of course, we read right here, if you go back, it says, and as they heard these things, he added and spoke a parable because he was near to Jerusalem, probably down around Jericho somewhere, and because they thought that the kingdom should immediately appear. So sometimes you have to figure out what a parable's about. Sometimes you don't. This one, we don't have to figure it out because Luke says, here's why he said it. Here's why I'm putting it here. Because people thought that the kingdom was coming right now, and you know that Jesus was going to establish it just then and there. And so Jesus had this to say because of their misperception. So we don't have to wonder. We don't have to wonder what it's about. Let me make sure I don't forget anything here. You know, these people were looking for what our modern terminology are. What do we have? What's the word? Euphemism. We call it regime change. We used to call it like revolution or overthrow. Now we say regime change. That sounds a little less violent, right? Well, they were looking for regime change. All right? they were looking for the kingdom of God to appear. Their messianic expectations, if you want to put it that way, were very high. Near Jerusalem. All right, I'm ready to go to the next page here. And some of the terminology Luke uses when he writes on this travel narrative is terminology that's connected with royalty. So he's making the point that Jesus is a king. He's born to be a king and so forth. The timing is different. You know, Luke understood that by the time he wrote this, but the people didn't understand that at the time. Verse 12 says, he said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. So why is he telling the story? Because they thought the kingdom was going to appear right away. And the beginning of his story, he says, a certain nobleman, doesn't identify, doesn't matter, is going to go away into a far country. So what does that tell you about the trip? That is the trip that in the parable here, the trip in the story. It's going to take a long time. So the first thing Jesus is, the first point that comes out in the parable here is that the kingdom of God, in other words, because that's the purpose of the parable, right? The kingdom of God is not going to come right away. It's going to be a long time. Because the analogy here is to a long journey. Long journeys take a long time. This makes sense. So the kingdom of God is not tomorrow, it's not the next day, it's going to be a while. And that Jesus is making the point here that this nobleman has to leave and go somewhere and come back. So there's not only going to be an interval of time, but the nobleman, who obviously pictures Jesus in this parable, that I think we all agree there, don't have to demonstrate that, that Jesus is going to have to go somewhere and come back. There's a return. Can't return unless you leave. All right, so that just makes sense there. And it says, also interestingly, it says, he goes to receive a kingdom and then to return. So how do you receive a kingdom somewhere else? How does that work? What's that? Is it telling us something there?
Coronation.
Yeah, what's it telling us about it? That this individual, that this nobleman has to go somewhere else to receive his kingdom. What is somewhere else? Someone even higher. I guess, I mean, you know, he has to go somewhere else to receive the kingdom. So even Jesus has to go somewhere where there's somebody who has the authority to confer on him the kingship. Now, that's the story. Let's talk about history just for a moment. You might be aware of these things. Herod, that has been talked about plenty of times in sermons in the past, including a sermon or two that Jim gave on the Herod family in particular and how horrible they were in some ways, very violent and so forth, to their own, as well as the people. Herod in 40 BC had traveled to Rome to make a case that he would be appointed king of, I don't know, it's hard to say, king of the territory there around Jerusalem. Now, there's different names for it, depending on whether it was a Roman province or a kingdom, you know. But there was this Hasmonean kingdom. You know, the Maccabees and their descendants had this kingdom. The Romans came under, what was it, Pompey, I believe, or whoever it was, in 63 BC. They conquered the area, and now it was under Roman jurisdiction. So if somebody wanted to be king, they had to do it with Rome's blessing. So Herod makes this trip to Rome, and he talks to Mark Antony, which is a good thing to do because Mark Antony seems to be in control. And he gets approval to be king. And he comes back and he's king. Problem with being Mark Antony's getting approval from. I take it back. I got to correct myself. I think he talked. Mark Anthony was later, but he got approval. Eventually, it was with Mark Anthony. It might not have been Mark Anthony in 40 BC. I'm not real clear on that. Sorry. But anyway, he definitely got approval from the Romans to be king. I don't remember Mark Anthony's exact dates. So he gets approval. Now Herod dies somewhere around 4 BC. So we have this history of somebody from the area going to Rome, becoming king. And the deal with Mark Anthony, I've told you before, he was loyal to Mark Anthony, but eventually it's Augustus, it's Octavian who wins out and he becomes Caesar, right? And Herod has to make another trip. I believe he made another trip. He says, you know, yeah, I was loyal to Mark Anthony, but if you think I'm loyal to him, wait till you see how loyal I'll be to you. Point was, Herod wanted to be a king, and he would, you know, kiss anybody's toes in order to be king. He didn't care who they were. And he was loyal to Augustus or to Octavian. He built Caesarea, you know, so Caesarea we say a lot of times. He built a beautiful city there on the coast of the Lake of Sea of Galilee. Named it after Caesar. He built another place that he named after some relative, I forget. But you know, he acknowledged his subservience to Caesar. Okay, fast forward to 4 BC or around there, Herod dies. He's got some sons that are left that he hasn't killed off. He was a lot of violence in his family. But one of them is Archelaus. And Archelaus wants to be king. But the people hated Archelaus because he was already known for being a bad guy. And he goes out to Rome and he asks Augustus this time. He asks the Caesar if he can be king. Now Augustus, Octavian, now Augustus Caesar, he was a good Caesar, if there's such a thing. I mean, he was a good emperor. He was smart. He cared for the people. I'm not saying he didn't do bad things, but he was a good administrator. And what happened with on this trip is that they didn't quite trust Archelaus yet, and they made him something called ethnarch, whatever in the world that means. He could be in charge of his people, but he wasn't a king. He had to prove himself in order to become king. And as history bears out, he didn't prove himself. He was massively unpopular, and the Romans eventually banished him to Gaul, which is France today, which then was the boonies. That's like sending them to the boonies. So they sent him to Gaul, and he had to stay there with, his wife or something. Do I want to tell you now or save it for later? I'm not sure. I think I'm going to save it. There's something else in this story. But he wanted to rule in his father's place. Augustus was wise enough to not make him king, but give him a trial period, call him an ethnarch. He never did become king, and eventually the Romans governed Samaria, Judea, and so forth. That's what he wanted to be. He wanted to be king of Samaria and Judea, which is like upper Galilee is and downward Judea is, and Idumea, which is the other side of the Jordan, where the country of Jordan is today. He wanted to be king of that area. And eventually, because he didn't pan out to be king, Rome just appointed people like Pilate to be the governors of these areas. Although Galilee, his brother Antipas got Galilee. Fuzzy on some of the details there, but the point is that he had to go to Rome to get that. So this idea of going to receive a kingdom had historical connections with the people. The people could understand, yeah, this is what the Herods do. They got to go to Rome in order to be king. So Jesus isn't just making something up out of the blue. He's got some historical stuff that went on that these people are aware of, and he uses that to fashion his parable. Excuse me. Okay, now we get to verse 13. It says, he called his 10 servants. This is this nobleman, right, that's going to go. Before he leaves, he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds, or 10 minas, as Arlene read, and said to them, occupy, this is King James, occupy till I come. Arlene, what does yours say?
Minas.
Mine says occupy till I come back.
Engage in business, then what?
Engage in business till I come. And that's the right meaning. It means do something. Be active here. Be doing something until I come. Until I come back. Now, there is some discussion on whether until is the best translation. It could be a translation that has more to do with because. No, do business because I'm coming back. It could be either way. But until is okay. Doesn't change the point too much. There are 10 servants. There are 10 minus. Each one gets one. Why 10? I don't know. But there's one thing, and these are things that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't read a bunch of different sources. One of those sources said, and this makes perfect sense, at least by having 10, you can deduce and know for sure that he's not just making a specific story here that applies to the 12 disciples, that they are the ones that have this job. It's not just the 12, because it's not 12 at all. It's 10. It's a generic number, kind of a, 10. 10 is a round number, right? So we can conclude that it applies to all disciples, not just the specific 12 or 11 if you don't count Judas or whatever. It doesn't apply to a specific group of people in terms of that were alive at that time. It applies to all disciples. These are slaves. These are his slaves. He gives each one a mina. And there's 10 of them. Matthew only has 3. Interestingly, here we have 10, but it only talks about 3 of them. They got 1 pound or 1 mina each. A mina, how much is a mina? Well, mine is 100 drachmas, now you know, okay? You were wondering. What's a drachma? Drachma's about a day's wage. The denarius, it's translated denarius sometimes. It's about a day's wage for a guy working in the fields. All right, so 100 days' wages is 3 to 4 months' worth of work, right? So your salary for 3 to 4 months' worth of work. So that's what they're given here to work with. They're given about 3 or 4 months' wages. That's not a huge amount, but it's something. It's significant. To give you a little bit of background, Mark Anthony had some troops. You remember that Anthony was in competition with Julius Caesar and what's the other one's name? Is it, I forget now. But these guys would have their own armies. And Antony's army complained one time because he gave him a gift, and the gift was 1 mina. And they complained, and he had to increase it. So it wasn't it was something, but it wasn't a whole lot. On the other hand, just for your own benefit, and this makes a point that I'll make in a minute, but in Matthew, they're given a talent. And a talent, let's see if I get this. I wrote it down because I wouldn't remember it. A talent is 60 minus. All right, so that's about 20 years worth of wages. All right, and in Matthew, one of them was given 5 talents, right? So that's over a lifetime salary. That's a lot of money. And one was given 2 and one was given 1. But that was a ton of money. Talent is a measurement of gold or silver or whatever. Weight. So, one point that I got from this is that you have Matthew, which is a huge sum of money given to these people, and then in Luke you have a decent sum of money, but it's nowhere near, not even, it's a different order of magnitude than in Matthew. And that tells me something. And there's other evidence for this. And that is that what's central here is not how much money is involved, how much they're given or how much they earn. That's not the main point. Because in one story we have tremendous amount of money, in one story we don't. But the impact of the story is the same. So I think that we can deduce from that it's not about how much money you start with or even how much money you end up with. It's about something else, or at least primarily about something else. There are differences too, and I'll just point, I think this is where I want to stop and just point out some of the differences between Matthew and Luke. Matthew's story, again, has 3. Luke's version here has 10. I don't think they're versions of the same parable. I think they're totally different parables. In Matthew, this individual's going off and he gives these 3 individuals his possessions. In other words, they're caretakers or stewards of what he owns while he's gone. In Luke, he just gives these people something to invest while he's gone. So it's a, maybe making a slightly different point there. And it says in the King James, occupy or be busy. Arlene's says trade. You know, be active, be actively using this money to make more money. Let's invest it. We would use the term invest. Let's, you know, invest this money and do something with it. And when it's translated until I return, it kind of puts a time limit on it, right? Like, you know, there's a, you only have till I come back, and you better have, and we kind of think it almost is like, get the most you can in the time you have. I don't think that's really the primary point. Like I said, it could be translated because. In other words, you need to do this. You need to work for me because I am leaving. I can't be here and do it myself. I'm going somewhere else. You now have the responsibility to act in my absence. Now, there's a difference in there, isn't it? A difference in intent, maybe. And I think this is crucial to understanding the both parables. That there's a difference between I want you to make some money for me while I'm gone, and I want you to represent me while I'm gone. There's two different things. And I think there's evidence as we go through the parable, there's evidence to support that. Now, verse 14 is interesting because it says, but his citizens hated him, and they sent a message after him saying, we won't have this man to rule over us. So he's going to get a kingdom, but then they sent this, they sent a message along with somebody to say, hey, we don't like this guy. We don't want him to be our ruler. Well, guess what? This is the part I left out of the story about Archelaus. When Archelaus went to Rome to ask to be king of Judea and Samaria and Idumea, the other side of the Jordan, the Jews already couldn't stand him. They didn't like Herod, for that matter. They certainly didn't like his sons. And he had murdered a bunch of Jews, and so I forget what happened, what the incident was, but he was tremendously unpopular. And they sent a delegation of 8,000 people, and I don't think all 8,000 were for Jerusalem. I think you had a lot of local Jews there in Rome and whatever, but they had this huge delegation of people that they sent to Rome, or that were already in Rome, that represented their interests. It said, this guy's coming, he wants to be our king. He's the last person in the world we want as our king. Please, no. So when Jesus, again, has got this story, right, and he's got a story, he says that there's a people don't want this guy to rule over them. There's a historical reality that happened, you know, roughly 30 years prior to this time. And the people knew about this. They knew about Archelaus. And by this time, Archelaus was already in Gaul, you know, counting the daisies or whatever he was doing there. I don't know what he was doing, but he was off the pasture. So the people were aware of that. People were aware of that. He was brutal. Archelaus was brutal, and they didn't want him to be king. So in the story here, and I kind of think that, I don't know. I don't know whether Jesus is putting these together this way in the way he's telling the story, or if Luke is putting two stories together into one. It seems like they're two different stories, and they kind of fit awkwardly, but they're both important. They just don't seem to go together as smoothly as maybe they could. So maybe Luke's putting two together, I don't know. This part of the story, the fact that they sent some people to try to persuade the Romans not to make Archelaus king. That this particular nobleman that was going off had people that didn't like him. That's left out of the Matthew 25 account. So again, that's evidence to me that they're different accounts altogether. But people debate about that. We can't know for sure. Throughout this travel narrative from Luke 9 to Luke 19 and throughout the Gospels, we have one thing, we have a lot of themes, but one of the themes is that some of the people, and definitely most of the leaders, rejected Jesus. The Gospels are a story of Jesus' rejection, right? You remember back in, I wrote it down, Luke 9 in verse 51, if you want to write it down. That's where Jesus is at the beginning of this journey down to Jerusalem. And he sends some people out ahead of him to let the towns know that he's coming, kind of get a crowd together so when he shows up he's got somebody to preach to and some place to stay and so forth. And when he sends them to one place in Samaria, the people know that he's headed to Jerusalem. He's not just coming to preach to them and stay there. So they reject him. They say, I know, we're not interested in having you stay with us because you're going to Jerusalem anyway. And that's when James and John, you know, want to bring fire down from heaven on these people. And Jesus said, no. I came to save people, not to burn them up. But the point is that Jesus is rejected, sometimes by the people, as they're in Samaria, sometimes by the leaders, almost always by the leaders he's rejected. So we have, the Gospels are full of stories of Jesus' rejection. And so here in this parable, we also have that, where you have a contingent of people in this parable that when the nobleman's going off to receive a kingdom, you have these other people that say, we don't want this man to rule over us. So it fits with Jesus as well, because Jesus was constantly faced with rejection. In verse 15, okay, move on. It says, it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called to him to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. That's what it says in the King James. So we get to trading. You know, that's what the occupying was, to trade. So he received the kingdom. It happens while he's away, because he's going somewhere else where the authority is. And that's what literally happens with Jesus. We understand that. He goes back to heaven to his Father and receives the kingdom. And in a way, the kingdom's here now. He's already king, but he hasn't established rule over the earth. We read in Revelation and elsewhere that, you know, he's going to come back and then establish his control over earth. But he's already king. He's already been given the responsibility. This is another thing that the people, you know, talks about this parable being given because the people expected that this was going to happen like right away. Well, how did they think it was going to happen? They assumed that Messiah was not going to be only a religious leader, but also a military leader like their hero David. All right, so that this individual was going to lead an insurrection against the Romans. And when? You know, nobody would beat the Romans, but they thought, you know, with God's help, because it's Messiah and the prophecy said that they would win. So they expected Jesus not only to lead the people and be a spiritual man, but also to be a general and to lead them in a violent overthrow of the Romans, which they tried without Jesus, of course, with other would-be messiahs in 70 AD and 130 AD, and both were miserable failures. But that's what they thought. And so Jesus is giving this parable, saying, you know, I've got to go away. I'll come back later, a long time later, because it's a long journey. And you go somewhere else and receive the kingdom. You don't have to fight for it. Somebody with more authority, more power, gives you the kingdom. All right, now on to verse 16. It says, then came the first, saying, Lord, your pound has gained 10 pounds. So your mina has gained 10 minas. I had one, I got 11 now. That's a 1,000% gain. That's pretty good. Made a good investment, made a good call. And it's interesting, I would have never got this, but Kenneth Bailey puts it in his book. Notice it says, your pound has gained. What does that show about this particular servant? He says, your pound has gained 10 pounds. Does that show you anything about this servant?
He's a busy
man. Huh?
He's a busy man.
Well, he's busy, but what does it show you about his personality or his character?
He didn't
think
it was his own.
Hmm?
He didn't claim it as his own.
Didn't claim it as his own. Didn't claim it as his own. Didn't claim that he did anything great. It's kind of like your pound gained it. You know, it just kind of happened. Well, it didn't kind of happen. He worked hard, like Ray said, but he's humble about it. He's saying, your pound, you know, he didn't say, thanks for the opportunity. I've been looking forward to this all my life. Finally, somebody gave me a chance. I knew I was great, and look what I did. But, you know, on and on, talk about himself. He doesn't do that. He says, your pound gained 10 pounds. So it's humility. It's a good example. I don't think it's in there by mistake. I think Jesus had a point for putting that in there. It's as if you do what I say, the prophet will come. It's kind of, you know, maybe I'm reading into it a little bit, but maybe not. You know, the man worked, the man did what Jesus said, the slave did what Jesus said, and then, or what the nobleman said, sorry, I've got the story here. Did what the nobleman said, and when the nobleman came back, he said, here's what happened. You know, I had one, now I got 11. And all he did was do what the nobleman told him to do. He didn't have to be great or talented or whatever. And notice what the king does. Now he's king. He was a nobleman, now he's king, right? In verse 17, he says to him, well, you good servant, because you have been faithful in very little, have authority over 10 cities. What does the king have to be able to give out? Now he's king, so he can give out authority. That's what he has the right to do. And he gives authority over 10 cities. Now, we can look at this as a reward if we want. But I don't think so. Is it a reward to be mayor of 10 cities? That'd be a curse. It's hard enough to handle one, in a way. And I think probably a better way to look at it, and this is, other commentators said this, is that if you are good at this, I can give you other responsibility. There's a saying that was, I don't know at what era it was a popular saying, but it was something that's in Jewish literature. And it says, I got to read this so I get it right. Reward of duty done is duty to be done. Reward of duty done is duty to be done. In other words, you give more responsibility, you give more opportunity. It's not a reward in the sense of like, I work hard, I get more money, I go out and buy a Mercedes. That's not the point. The point is, you have proved well and responsible and reliable and trustworthy and so forth. I can let you be responsible for something more so that you'll be a benefit to them too. It's kind of like give a job to a busy person because they'll get it done. A little bit like that. So it's not really a reward in a sense of it's more duty, more responsibility. So I think that perhaps a way of looking at this is not how much money did you make by trading. You know, how much can you do for me in the kingdom? Or how much can I do? You know, in other words, how much profit can I make? But it's more a story here about whether or not we're willing to work for the king. Whether or not we're willing to work for the king. Because you have, well, as we'll see, you have two of the slaves that it doesn't talk about all 10, just talks about 3 of them. And 2 of the 3 work for the king. 1 says, I'm not going to do it. And there's more to it even than that. And that is that these individuals, these slaves, were asked to work for the king before he was king. And when it was just a promise of his return. And how do you know? How do you know if he's going to return? How do you know if when he returns he'll be king? Maybe he'll just be ethnarch. Or maybe he'll go there and get a flat out no and be somebody else be king. And then because I supported the wrong guy, I'm on the wrong side. There's all these thoughts you can put into the story here. So that maybe the most important thing is not that, yeah, I invested this money and I took one mina and made it into 10. But maybe it's more important to remember that this guy wasn't king yet, and in fact he was gone, and I represented him while he was gone, and I was faithful to him, even though he wasn't here, and even though he had enemies that didn't want him to become king, enemies that could be my enemies because I'm supporting him, but I was faithful to him. And then when he comes back and he's king, he rewards that faithfulness with more responsibility. So I think the key is faithfulness, not productivity or profit. It's being faithful to the cause, even though the king isn't there. Commitment to the mission, not percentage of return on investment. It's not a story, it's not a parable about high profits, I don't think. It's a parable about being faithful. Now we can look at verses 18 and 19, but there's nothing really added. It just talks about the second the second slave, and it's pretty much the same thing without the details, because we assume that the details are the same. And he gives him authority over five cities. And then verse 20, we get to another one. It says another one came. What does this say, Arlene? What does yours say again on the beginning of verse 20?
Then another came saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief.
Okay, it says another. Actually, in the Greek, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I could read this in the commentaries. It doesn't say another. It says the other, or the other one, as if there are only three. Of course, it only takes three to make the point. It really only takes two to make the point. You have one who's faithful and one who's not. Or maybe you have nine that are faithful and one that's not. But Luke only writes about three of them. But it's interesting that it says, really literally, it says the other one, not just any old other one. I think the point is that this other one was different than the other nine. You had nine who were faithful and you had one who wasn't. This is the other one. The other one. And you said, it says handkerchief in the ESV. King James says napkin. What it is, it's a word in Greek, because this is written in Greek, but it's a word they got from Latin. I wrote it down. What is it? A sudarium. But it's, if you ever seen the kind of, like, the, when they're in a real sunny climate, you have to work outside, and you have this hat, right? And then you've got this cloth that comes down the back of the hat to protect your neck. It's that cloth there. And it doesn't have to be connected to the hat. It's just a cloth that you wear around your neck to keep you from getting burnt on the back of your neck. And when you want to, you can grab that cloth and wipe your brow. And it's a sweat cloth or a cloth to protect you from the sun. And that's what it says he wrapped the mina in and hid it. You'll see in Matthew, by the way, it says that he has a talent and he buried it. Well, the talent of gold or silver or whatever would be too big to wrap in that thing, so you got to bury it. So what was this guy's problem? Well, we can read on a little bit more. Kept it laid up in a napkin or in this cloth. For I feared you, because you are an austere man. You take up that which you didn't lay down. Arlene says you get what interest on. You don't even deposit the money, and you get interest more or less. Says something like that. In other words, this guy, this slave had an opinion about this nobleman, who's now king, that he's a little bit, can I say, dishonest or finagling? In other words, you make money where you don't even invest. You make money where you don't even work. You benefit from other people's work. You take advantage of other people. You get interest when you don't even deposit your money. You get a crop even though you haven't sown. This guy is accusatory. He's got a picture in his mind of this nobleman who's now king. And it's not an accurate picture, is it? Because the guy just gave 10 cities to the one guy, gave 5 cities to another. You know, he's generous. He's not harsh. He's not austere. But that's what this slave thinks. And so this slave, you know, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. I just stuck it away where nobody could see it. He didn't do business. He didn't occupy. He didn't invest. He didn't do anything. And we could say, well, the king's upset because he didn't make him any money. I don't think so. Because he didn't seem to be, one guy made him 10, one guy made him 5. He didn't show, the rewards were different, but maybe that's because of ability. But it's not like he was displeased with the one compared to the other. He says in verse 22, the king said, well, out of your own mouth I'll judge you. You wicked servant. Now he calls him wicked. Why would he call him wicked? You know that I'm an austere man, taking up what I haven't sown, taking up what I haven't laid down and reaping what I haven't sown. Why didn't you then give my money to the banks and you know, at least I could get some interest. Now, if you'd have put money in the bank and got interest, that wouldn't be working very hard, would it? But the implication here is that the king would have at least been satisfied with that. And the king says, I'm going to judge you based on what you think about me. Now, he doesn't bother arguing with him about it and say, I'm not really that way. He just says, you think I'm that way? Okay, well, I'll be that way. I'll take the money from you. I'll give it to the guy who's got 10. So it's a mischaracterization. The king is not really this way. The first two slaves didn't feel that way. They knew the master better. What was the problem with this third slave? He didn't know the master. He didn't know his master, the nobleman, who is now king. He didn't really know him. He didn't really understand him. He didn't know where he was coming from. And he mischaracterizes him as being austere man and kind of mean and making money without even working for it and taking advantage of other people. And he's not willing to do anything for him. He's not willing to be publicly associated with him. He just hides the money. Doesn't want anybody to know he's even with the king or the guy who's now king. Not willing to take a risk. He's fearful. He says that, right? I feared. And he didn't believe in his master's goodness. You can write down Revelation 21, verse 8, where it talks about in the kingdom, who's not going to be there? The fearful and the unbelieving. This guy, this slave, was fearful and unbelieving. That's the problem, and that's why he gets in for so much criticism. Not that he didn't make any money, but that he didn't even try. Why didn't he try? The implication, I think, is that he didn't believe in his master. He didn't believe that he was going to be king. He didn't believe he was going to come back. And if he was going to come back, he wasn't going to be king. He's going to be, this slave was more worried about the people who wanted to see his master dead than he was worried about his master. And he wasn't willing to lift a finger. He's just going to hide in the background here. And I think that's why the king calls him wicked. He does because he does. He's an unbeliever. He doesn't believe in the king. He doesn't trust the king. He doesn't know the king. I wrote the scripture down. I think it's Matthew 12, verse 30. It said, if you're not with us, you're against us. This guy wasn't with them. He might as well have been in the group that sent the delegation to say, we don't want this guy to be king over us. He was against the king. Now how, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Verse 24 says that he said to them that stood by. Now, it doesn't say who stood by, but it could be his aides, could be seven slaves, I don't know. Them that stood by, take his mina and give it to the one who has 10. And they said unto him that, oh, Lord, he has 10 pounds. So we've got this Greek chorus. In the Greek tragedies and comedy, they had the chorus. And the chorus would, there was dialogue between the star, the actor, and the chorus. And here you kind of have the chorus. You got the crowd says, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. He's already got 10. Actually, he's got 11. He had one, he's got 10 more, now he's got 11. And the king says, under every one that has, it will be given, and from him that has not, taken even that which it seems that he has, or taken away from him what he has. You can write down, if you want, Luke chapter 8 and verse 18, where that proverb is there. It says, the to him that has, it'll be given more, and to him that doesn't, it'll be taken away even what it looks like he has. God is not unfair. He's just going to bless those that are working for him. This guy was not willing to lift a finger. He's not willing to work. He was unbelieving. He was unfaithful. And he was fearful. And the king called him wicked. So it seems, again, that I don't think this is about how much money or how you use your talents. It's a question of, are you going to do it or not? Do you believe in the king? Are you willing to work for the king even though he's got a bunch of people out there that want to see him dead? And that was literally the case with Jesus, right? You had the leadership wanted him dead. So these parables apply to him, obviously, and we can see that with hindsight. And verse 27, it says, but these mine enemies, which didn't want me to be king, bring here and slay them before me. You know, these are the enemies. So we have, in this story, I think we've got three categories. We have those that are faithful, which they only mentioned the two. It could have been the other slaves. Doesn't matter. But you got two slaves that were faithful, that were willing to stand in there and work for the king even when he was gone, even when perhaps there was a bit of uncertainty as to whether he would even return and whether he would have power when he returned. They were willing to stand in the gap and represent him while he was gone. And then you have the one servant who was unfaithful, he was still a servant, he was still a slave, but he was not faithful to the king. And then you have another category, and these are the people that never liked the king in the first place, didn't want him to be king, sent a delegation saying, please don't make him be king. So you got these different categories of people in this parable. So what about the faithful subjects? That's what we want to be, right? We want to be a faithful subject. What in the story can we, you know, maybe get some input here? What can we say about these faithful slaves, the two faithful slaves that are identified here? What can we say about them? Anything? They're willing to work for the king, even when he wasn't there. They're willing to, in a sense, hang a sign out and say, you know, King so-and-so, whatever. His royal, you know, whatever it was, however they traded, they were doing it on his behalf. They were willing to be out there in a public way associated with the king. Willing to risk. They were risking. Well, what if they would have lost money?
Well, they're also risking their lives, too, because if even had enemies, they could possibly kill, like
yes.
The disciples and the other.
Yes, they're willing to risk their lives. Because, yeah, he had enemies that wanted to see him dead. And they would obviously be your enemies, too. If you're not with us, you're against us. Yes.
They believed.
They believed the king. They believed what he said, or the nobleman that became king. They believed him. And to tie him with belief, they trusted him. They trusted him. And I think you could also say they knew him. They understood him, what he was really like. What about the unfaithful subject, the one who hid the money in the handkerchief? What about him? Yeah.
He didn't really know. He was either completely lying about his character or had misperceptions about him.
Yeah. He either lying about the nobleman's character or just didn't understand him. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Yes.
He was very judgmental.
He's judgmental. Okay. Yeah. He's critical. Not my fault. Your fault. Because you're less way. Yeah. Go ahead. He didn't value the potential. Very good. I didn't think about that. He didn't realize the potential. This guy's going to be king. You know, I can be part of a movement here that's going to be important. He chose not to be. He was faithless. He was unbelieving. Didn't trust the king. Yes. Nothing in it for him.
Right. Maybe. That's
yeah. One of the commentators pointed out, and I never would have thought of it, but you know, did Jesus have anybody in his circle? And you know, and you read through the Gospels, was there anybody that was associated with him that wasn't really part of the team?
Judas.
He was there. But when push came to shove, he didn't really believe, did he? He's willing to sell out his master for 30 pieces of silver. You know, he always had some kind of lingering doubt in there. He didn't see the future. So it seems to be almost an allusion to that. So how do we apply that to us? Well, are we willing to work for the king who's not here right now? He went and got a kingdom. He's got enemies. Got lots of enemies, seem to be more and more in this country. And yet we're called to represent him. Are we willing to do that? Are we willing to take the risk? Do we believe in his character? Do we believe in the future? And it's not about us, it's about him and the kingdom. Are we willing to publicly declare our loyalty in what amounts to enemy territory sometimes? Would we open up a shop in his name, you know, figuratively, with his name on the sign? Or are we fearful? We unbelieving? Maybe he's not coming back. Maybe he won't win. Maybe it'll be some other king. I'll be on the wrong side. Has to do with faith, doesn't it? I used a lot of resources when I researched this, but one of them, and this is a book that I've used before, I like Kenneth Bailey. He just recently died. But his insight into the parables is excellent, I think, probably because of living in the Middle East for most of his life. Although he's from, I don't know if he's from Pennsylvania, he lived in up around Pittsburgh when he died. But he's got a summary here that I want to share. You know, what can we pick up from this? What are the take-homes? And you've already said them, but I'll just read some of these. Not all of them. I don't agree with every single thing here, but he says, the anticipated fullness of the coming of the kingdom of God is in the unknown future, and it will be a while. In other words, the kingdom's not necessarily right around the corner. It's going to be a while. Now, that's, you know, it's sooner than it was in Paul's time, but, you know, the lesson here is we can't necessarily pin our hopes on it being tomorrow. We are given resources for fulfilling our master's commands. These are gifts, and when we have these gifts, we're accountable. We're accountable to the master. The master, now, this is Kenneth Bailey. This isn't some of the other resources, but I agree with this. The master's primary expectation from his servants is courageous public faith. Or courageous public faithfulness in an unseen manner in an environment where some are actively opposed to his rule. In other words, in a hostile environment, to be actively and openly supportive of the king. Humility is appropriate. Remember, your pound is turned into 10. The reward for faithfulness is greater responsibilities. This is wordy, but I'll read it. A static preservation of God's gifts is to betray the one who gives them. In other words, you can't just take what you have and wrap it in a handkerchief. We're supposed to use what we're given. And when we're unfaithful, that distorts our view of our master. So we get a wrong impression of him. There's other things there, but I hope this walk through this particular parable, and I'm not doing Matthew 25 right now, but it helped me to look at it. It's not just about, and not even mainly about, how much can you do for me, and how much profit can you make for me. That's not what God's about. He's about us being faithful. He gives us talents. Yes, we're to use them on his behalf. But that's up to him how much the return is, isn't it? I mean, we work. We can do a certain amount of things. But he's the one that, you know, it says, Paul, what does it say? Paul plant, Apollos water, God gives the increase. You know, we do what we can do, but it's God that gives the increase. And, you know, your pound has made 10 pounds, your pound made 5 pounds. You know, whatever we do for God, if we do something, God's the one that's responsible for the increase. But we have to do something. We can't just sit back and be unbelieving and unfaithful and say, I'm just going to hide it in a napkin. I'm not going to represent God. That's the warning there. Because if we do that, we're on the other side. If we're not for him, we're against him. So, the bottom line is we need to do something. We need to represent God in a world that is, for the most part, doesn't want to see him rule. But we've been given an opportunity to participate in the kingdom now, even before he comes back. And it's our job now to represent him and represent that kingdom in a hostile world.